You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another History of the Great War interview. This will be a first in a series of interviews where I chatted with the authors of a series of books being released by the Great War Group. The series is called Great War Group Introductions, and they are structured as books that are approachable to readers of any knowledge level about the Great War. Today, I was joined by Nikolai Eberholst, who has written a book titled simply, Austria-Hungary. The book is an overview of the experiences of Austria-Hungary during the war, the challenges that it faced, and an evaluation of its performance during the conflict. Austria-Hungary's role in the start of the war is probably the most covered part of its entire experience in the conflict. The entire course of events in July 1914 is, of course, a topic far too large for an introduction to an interview. But by the end of the second week of August, Austria-Hungary would be at war with Serbia, Russia, Britain, France, and Montenegro. In the years that followed, Italy and Romania and the United States, along with several other nations, would follow. As a general overview of the course of the war, when the war began, Austria-Hungary would attack Serbia, while also defending itself from the Russian attacks in Galicia. In both cases, these efforts would be classified as a failure. And in Serbia, the attacks would fail to remove the small Balkan nation from the war, while in the east, the Russian advance would overrun much of Galicia. These failures against Russia would be the setup for the disastrous Carpathian campaigns during the winter of 1914 to 1915. The fighting that would occur over the winter, with the Austrians attempting to push the Russians back to relieve the beleaguered fortress of Przemyśl, would be done in some of the worst conditions of the entire war. To say that men literally froze to death during the attacks is not an exaggeration. The result of the first 6 months of the war was disastrous for the Austro-Hungarian army. The total number of casualties among Austro-Hungarian armies engaged in the theater of the Carpathians was around 50%, a staggering percentage, even by First World War standards. After the disasters against the Russians, in early 1915, Italy would join the war against Austria-Hungary, adding another problem that had to be handled. The fighting along the two nations' shared border along the Isonzo is infamous for its futility and suffering. The fighting is often portrayed from the Italian perspective, often, you know, really questioning why they would attack in the same area 11 times. While I don't disagree with that mindset, it is at least does say something positive for the Austro-Hungarian troops that were defending against the Italian attacks. On the Italian front, the Empire's troops would prove to be an incredibly resilient force, and able to match Italian aggression with constant counterattacks and a brutally violent defense. On the Russian front, there would be both successes and failures. The Gorlice-Tarnov offensive of May 1915, launched in conjunction with the German army, would be an incredible success. Then in 1916, the Brusilov offensive would result in a major defeat, although it would once again be a defeat that the Austro-Hungarian army would eventually recover from to prevent further Russian advances. 1917 would be the years of the great victories for Austria-Hungary, with the Russian summer offensives being stopped very quickly and then the great victory of Caporetto. Caporetto would be the first major change in the Italian front since the beginning of the war, but Italy would still remain in the war. 1918 would then be a very tough year for Austria-Hungary, with economic problems around food and industrial production nearly grinding everything to a halt. So many essentials for both life and fighting became almost unheard of in Austria-Hungary by the end of the war. And by the time of the final offensive of the war, which were targeted at Austria-Hungary, soldiers at the front were being issued paper underwear and were on ration levels that were simply non-sustaining. Over the course of the interview, we talk at some length about the evaluation and perception of Austria-Hungary's performance and contribution to the war. It's a topic that's often tainted by the shadow of the empire's early failures and a general focus on histories on telling the story of the war from the perspective of Austro-Hungarian enemies. After the interview, if you would like to find out more about Austria-Hungary during the war, check out the link in the episode description or head on over to greatwargroup.com where you can find a list of all of the Great War Group introductions, which I'm told are going to be shipping on October 11th, which is today.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another History of the Great War interview. This time, I am joined by Nikolai Eberholst, the author of Austria-Hungary, which is coming from the Great War Group Introductions book series that's coming out soonish, if you're listening to this episode on release, and also the creator of the Pike Gray 1418 Twitter account, which has been going on since July 2017, and is a fantastic source for random pictures of the Austro-Hungarian army during the war and other Eastern European matters. So I just want to start off this interview, you know, with what has drawn you to the history of Austria-Hungary during the First World War?
Yeah, I actually started being interested more in World War II. And then I slowly got more into World War One, and I just found that I've always been drawn to the odd things in whatever topic that I dive onto. So I've never really, it wasn't the Western Front that caught my interest. It was first the Italian Front, and then of course from there. Going on the fact that I spoke German at least understood and read German and not Italian sort of picked it for me in that way. But I've always been going for the odd things, not the one that everybody else is trying to do, and trying to find a place where I can see that there is something that I feel needs to be, like a story that needs to be told that isn't being told as much. Of course, there are other people talking about it. It's not a unique idea to talk about Austria-Hungary, but of course, it's much more focused. That is the history of the First World War on the Western Front, on Britain, and this. And then, of course, I can go and focus on Germany as the other part, but then why not take one step further and go for the other one on that alliance? So yeah, that's how I got into it, and then I just found my niche point.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I've really enjoyed sort of following your Twitter account over the years and seeing the pictures that, you know, you surface on that account that show what it was like over on the other side of the war.
Yeah, I think purely because that's just a way to promote myself and build a following and do things. Of course, on Twitter, it's not the only thing, but I do think that we can learn a lot by seeing and like a visual representation of this whole other thing that for most people seem like something completely foreign that they haven't seen before, because you can see the differences in I get so many comments on how for example trenches look different on the Eastern Front than on the Western Front. You see how many comments about, oh, are they still wearing cloth hats in 1916? Yes, of course they are, because it's a whole different kind of war and a whole different kind of economical power behind the army. So there are a lot of different aspects that by showing a photo you can get into a conversation with people and talk about like what is the differences and bring it up that way. So while it is not the only thing that I do show pictures, I think it really works in a good way to start the conversation.
So speaking of sort of Austria-Hungary in the war, so what were their plans in the event of a war? So everybody kind of knew that a war was probably going to happen at some point. Everybody was kind of thinking about it. So how had they prepared for a conflict, and what were they planning to do should it occur?
Yeah, if we start with the preparation, because I think that is what determines a lot of the Austro-Hungarian war planning at the time. Austria-Hungary is, of course, this this split nation. It's a dual monarchy with two halves. One control. Well, one is Hungary and one is Austria, as the name implies. And there is a lot of tension between these two. And the Hungarians, for a long time before, are very strict on the budget for the military, because they feel the military is being controlled mainly by the Austrian, the Austro-Germans, or the Germans, if you call it as a nationality. But they're feeling that they are the ones who are controlling it, and they are very reluctant to give a lot of money to the army, feeling that the army could be used to quell Hungarian independence and their sort of sovereignty within the dual monarchy. So there isn't a lot of money to go by, which means that the peacetime army is quite small. It's only about 450,000 people for an enormous empire with a lot of inhabitants. There are 50 million people, or around 50 million people in 1914 in Austria-Hungary. It's the third most populous country in Europe at the time, only after Germany and Russia. But it's a very, very small army. It also means that the percentage of people going into the armed services, like the number of men per thousand or something, is much lower in Austria-Hungary than it is in a lot of the other countries, which means that Austria doesn't have a lot of people to draw on once mobilization is declared. One other thing they will run out of is, of course, reserves when casualties comes in, and you have to replace the ones who are going off in the first place. You don't have the men already trained and already prepared for it. At least you don't have enough, and Austria-Hungary is going to need a lot very, very quickly. But because they have this small army, As I said, 450,000 in a peacetime army, and upon mobilization, it goes up to about like 1.8 million, which is still a relatively small army. It's about divided into roughly 60 divisions, some like 40, 48 or something infantry and 11 cavalry or something like that. But for example, France will have 88 divisions upon mobilization. And they're a country with fewer inhabitants. So it is a small army. And of course, Austria-Hungary is also a country that, due to political tensions, we shouldn't get too much into now, but it is a country that is already realizing in the years before the war that they're being surrounded by hostile powers. I mean, pretty much everybody is a potential enemy for Austria-Hungary except for Germany, which is their ally, and neutral Switzerland, which is probably not going to be an issue. Even countries like Italy, who is let's call them a public ally, they don't really trust them to begin with. And then Romania, which is sort of a secret ally, they have a secret treaty with the king that he's going to support, and which also doesn't come to anything, of course, when war is declared. But even those two countries are there might be actually come a war after all, even though we are allies. So they're facing either a very local war with just one power, which could most realistically be something like Serbia or Italy or Russia. Those are the main ones they're working with in their war planning. But it's very likely that it will become a multi-front war very quickly. And because they have a very small army, they have about six field armies is what they will be divided into in the event of war. They really quickly realize that if a multiple front war comes, they won't have the necessary armies to be fully prepared on every single front, which means that the planners, the general staff, doesn't have enough men at the start to do exactly what they want, which is, of course, to go on the offensive anywhere. So what they're planning is they're writing up different scenarios, different war plans. So they will have a war plan S, war plan B for the Balkans, which, of course, why I say S is because it's mainly towards Serbia. Then a war plan R, which is against Russia. They will also have one I against Italy. And then they will also have something like R plus S. So if it's both of them together, working together, which is the most likely scenario the B plus R would be Serbia plus Russia against Austria-Hungary. And then they're trying to build as much flexibility into their war plans as possible during peacetime so that they will be able to react when things get rolling. If one country joins the war against them, they can do one thing. If it then changes, they should be able to do something else. So what they do is they divide their army into three parts. They have what is called the Minimalgruppe Balkan, which is consists of two armies, which will deploy on the Serbian front in Bosnia and Dalmatia against Montenegro and Serbia, effectively. Then they have the A group, which is the largest, more than half the army, consisting of three armies in total, will deploy on the Eastern Front in Austria-Hungary. They actually talk about it as the Northern Front, which can be a bit confusing, but for most people, let's talk about it as the Eastern Front against Russia. They will deploy in Galicia and be ready to move there. And then they have the flexibility part, which is the B group, consists of the second army, which can either move to Serbia if you want to go on the offensive there, or they can go to Galicia against Russia if you need them there. So that's how they're planning to do it and trying to build in the flexibility so that depending on what happens, they will have men enough in either place. Of course, this goes horribly wrong when war is declared, because they sort of Russia isn't in it to begin with, and the Austro-Hungarian chief of the general staff, Konrad von Hötzendorf, he decides that he will try to strike a very quick blow against Serbia first. So what he does is, upon declaration of war with Serbia, he decides to mobilize the Minimalgruppe Balkan, which is the two armies against Serbia and Montenegro, and then send the B group to Serbia. Then, of course, things move on, and over the next couple of days, it becomes pretty clear that, that Russia will join in this war against Germany and Austria-Hungary and intervene in this. So they decide to change it up and say, okay, we have to send B group, the flexibility group, back to Galicia, because that's where we have to do it now. But at that point, you've already started the mobilization of the A group, which means that they have to finish first, because you don't have the rolling stuff. You don't have enough of all of this to go about it. And they will have to fully deploy before you can start moving this force that has been sent to the wrong place, essentially, because now it's much more serious what's happening in the East than what's happening in the Balkans all of a sudden. What essentially happens is that this one army, they're desperately needing an army extra everywhere, because they don't have enough, and they basically waste the whole of August and September moving one of their six armies all over the place, and it doesn't really participate in anything. It's in the Balkan too short to actually do anything and make a difference there, and it only arrives in Galicia to take part in the defeat. So even with the fewer armies and the too few people, they even waste some of that, just messing up the mobilization and the planning.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, reading about sort of Austria-Hungary's position before the war and when the war starts, they don't have enough resources to do everything that they want to do. But then they make the worst possible decision, which is not just committing to something. Like, with your reserves, you need to pick a spot and go, not sort of flip-flop right in the middle, causing the worst possible scenario.
Yeah, it really is that exact the problem, that they do end up really making the worst choices that they can in the situation that they're in, and their attempt, which is not an unreasonable and not a dumb attempt given their situation, to build in flexibility sort of becomes a big issue, because it doesn't work out. Of course, you can always go back and say, oh, they should have known that Russia would come in and they should have just done that. But yeah, it's easy to do in hindsight. And I think we can all agree that it is not the right decision that is made. And they should have thought about it, and they shouldn't have focused on Serbia as much as they did. But then again, Serbia is the main enemy. That is why they started the war. And there is a belief that they might actually be able to launch this quick offensive before Russia is ready, but Russia is much faster in mobilization, in mobilizing their own forces than anybody expects, which means that suddenly you have to move all your forces east. Then again, you also have a really bad cooperation or coordination between Germany and Austria, meaning that there isn't really a good agreement of what is going to happen here. And this I mean, the Austrians are not completely involved in this whole German Schlieffen plan idea of sending everything west first and leaving the east relatively undefended, except for a single army in East Prussia. They're not thinking all the time that, oh, we have to carry the whole load in the east to begin with. And again, you can criticize it, and you can look, and did they not know, and was it just, did it just play into to Chief of General Staff Conrad's way of telling the story later to say that there wasn't this, but there is he has an idea that there will be a coordinated attack from both sides in the east. Of course, this is unrealistic given that the Germans only have one army. But the plans are not really written for that. So there are things that you don't know, and things where you can say, okay, that's stupid. Yeah, but you don't know until it gets going completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Could not agree more. So you kind of touched on it there a little bit, but I would say the overall perception of the Austro-Hungarian efforts during the war are not favorable, bordering on complete failure. Do you think that this is a fair assessment of their contribution to the sort of Central Powers war effort?
Both yes and no. I mean, you can always look at all the bad ones, but a lot of it comes from a few things that go wrong in the beginning. I mean, there are always issues in the Austro-Hungarian army with the leadership. The leadership has issues. There are really bad generals in the Austro-Hungarian armies. There are also some very, very good ones. But there are a lot of bad ones, and a lot of them are also in quite high positions, which create a lot of problems, of course, as it would. But as the German allies also always seem to admit, is that there's nothing wrong with the Austro-Hungarian soldier as a soldier. And when you look at how the Austro-Hungarian soldier fights when he is competently led, either by his own or by, say, German forces, German generals, or in close cooperation with German forces, which happens a lot in the East, going from 1915 on, they're performing well, or as well as their allies. And they are winning battles. It's often when they're on their own, and when their chief Conrad decides to go on these already doomed, unrealistic adventures, one could be tempted to say, but these offensives that everybody is saying, oh, that shouldn't happen. Or the Germans are saying that this is nuts. You can't win this. You can't do it. But he wants to do it because he wants to win back some prestige lost in earlier battles, and he wants to win his own battles. And he doesn't want Austria-Hungary to play second fiddle to Germany all the time and just be a subordinate to Germany, which is also a legitimate position to take, given that it is an empire. It is not an alliance where it is already decided that Germany will be the main one, and the others just have to follow. So you can again criticize him for saying, "Oh, you should just go as the Germans want." But then again, that is also a lot to ask for a country or an empire like Austria-Hungary to just submit fully to their allies. But yeah, if you want to talk about like what goes wrong is and how that affects the way it is, the whole, as we talked about, the whole bundling of the mobilization messes up things for Austria-Hungary in both Serbia and in Galicia, and they lose a lot of people. Lose in total about a quarter of a million men within the first month and a half of the war, which is an incredible amount of casualties to take for a country that doesn't really have, as we said before, a prepared reserve. They don't have the men to fill it up. They have to quickly train new officers. The casualties in Galicia amongst the officer corps is like 75%. It is all the peacetime officers, all the peacetime trained soldiers, the well-trained ones, the ones who've done the education, as well as we haven't really talked about, is a multinational army, and everybody speaks different languages. And before the war, there is a requirement for officers to learn the languages of the men that they're commanding. That works well in peacetime, of course, but it doesn't work well when you have to train new officers within a few weeks or a few months. They don't have the time to learn four or five different languages because they're being sent to a very a very polyglot regiment. So of course you don't have that. So because of these incredible casualties they have in the beginning, because of some of the unpreparedness, they do not rise again from the early blows. And when you then get into something like the bigger campaigns that they participated in 1915, like the Carpathians, where they lose 800,000, or they suffer 800,000 casualties in a number of months. This is something that leaves the army completely depleted of everything from, you know, uniforms to ammunition to food to trained personnel. You have to reduce the requirements for the standards of recruitment. You have to reduce the time that you train people. You have to reduce the amount of like rifle rounds that they can fire before they go to the front. All of this will add on to them having to really, not have to, but that they will struggle a lot throughout the war with already trying to make up this whole mess that they're in from the beginning. But I mean, if we look at some of the classic blunders, it is the Serbian campaigns in 1914. It's Galicia. We have the whole Carpathians. We have the Brusilov offensive. These are some of the major ones that people think of where there's a lot of casualties, where it really goes wrong, where the Germans will have to come in and save them. But then there are also all the other ones in between, and some of them are a lot in between, where it actually goes quite well. The Gorlice-Tarnow offensive in the east is often portrayed as a German victory, but a lot of the soldiers are Austro-Hungarian soldiers. There are Austro-Hungarian armies participating in it under German leadership, but there's a lot of Austro-Hungarian soldiers fighting these battles. You have the Romanian campaign. Austro-Hungarian soldiers perform well. First Army under Arts von Stausenburg, who later becomes the Chief of General Staff after Conrad, does well in Romania. Then you, of course, have the famous defensive battles on the Isonzo, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, defensive victories for Austria-Hungary, which is a purely Austro-Hungarian front for most of the war, except for a very, very, very brief few months in 1917 from September, where there isn't any battles, but in an active combat role, it's only from late October to the end of December that German troops are there in any significant numbers for the Caporetto offensive. But otherwise, it's a purely Austro-Hungarian venture, and they do well and fight well. And yes, you can always say that, oh, God created the Italian army for Austria-Hungary to have somebody to beat, or the other way around. But they're not bad armies, and they do fight well. And these battles are bloody, and they swallow up a lot of resources, and they would have swallowed up a lot of resources of Germans as well. And then you can look at even to the very last days of the war, Austria-Hungary is fighting still. They have an incredible durability in staying in, despite all these casualties. They're in the war until November 4th, so just a week before the Germans are out as well. And in Italy, during the Vittorio Veneto offensive in October and into November of 1917, there are points of that front where they're fighting and winning local fights, defensive fights with barely any ammunition, no food at all, no uniforms, basically just rags, men without boots and everything. They're still fighting, and they're still able to maintain their positions and hold on to trenches and make counterattacks and local counterattacks. You also have a few divisions going to the Western Front in the middle of 1918. To fight the Americans and the French during the Saint-Mihiel offensive and during the Meuse-Argonne offensive. And they also perform well and are commended for what they're doing by the Germans and by newspapers around the world. You have American newspapers saying that, oh, Germany has been saved by Austria and these local positions on some heights because they do fight well and they do, I mean, they have no chance of winning, no chance at all. But they're doing well and they're fighting as well as they can, delaying the enemy, allowing other units to retire to a better position, all these things. So yeah, you can always laugh at Austria-Hungary and say they're incompetent in this and that. But they did fight well, and they did last a very long time.
I generally think that they're kind of their legacy from the war in terms of on the military side of things is something where did they make some pretty big mistakes, especially early on? Yes. But the fact that they were able to recover in any meaningful way from that first catastrophic 6 or 7 months is really impressive. Given their sort of industrial base, their manpower base, their sort of trained soldiers that they were working with, that they were able to recover and still participate meaningfully in multiple different offensives on multiple different fronts over the next several years is impressive.
Yeah, I think you touch on something important, that they're doing very well with what they're given to begin with. They don't have the industrial facilities to produce a lot of weapons and munitions and all this stuff immediately. I mean, they're struggling to produce helmets in the end of the war and basic equipment. And so already in 15, they're producing ersatz, replacement material, uniforms and equipment. And you get to the point where you're producing cardboard belts and bags and backpacks and stuff like that made of strings of paper that have been impregnated to resist water and stuff like that. And all these things that does not make soldiers confident. and when you take away the food and you take away the warmth and security and all these things that disappear in the end in the last 7-8 months, primarily, where you really see a catastrophic situation on the Italian front, and of course also the other fronts, but mainly on the Italian front, there really isn't anything left. But the army still stays and it still goes on the offensive in June 1918, a hopeless offensive again. But they go on a major offensive in June of 1918, and they do not break then, and they only break when the end is completely near, basically, and there is no way out anymore.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned all these sort of economic issues that are causing serious problems at the front in terms of food and supplies and everything. In a lot of European nations, they all on the citizen side of things, on the home front, everybody was affected. So what was life like in Austria-Hungary during the war? Did they also suffer from these same kinds of sort of critical shortages?
Yes. There are several factors that are interesting about the home front when you talk about Austria-Hungary. And some historians do talk about it as in home fronts, because there's many different home fronts depending on where you are in this multinational empire. It is not the same whether you live in Bohemia or you live in Austria or you live in Hungary. It's a very different situation, and there's of course many similarities as well, but Austria-Hungary is, of course, as Germany and as Bulgaria and all these other central powers, they're really suffering under the naval blockade, which prevents them from importing food and a lot of the materials, war materials that they need to produce everything, from things they need on the home front, things they need in the war economy. in the war industry. But there are also some really, really poor administration of what they have, and they make a lot of mistakes that just further the problem along the way. And there are also for Austria-Hungary, there's a very big difference of whether you live in the city or whether you live in the rural side. People in rural areas generally have a little more because they often have the ability to grow food themselves. The situation inside the cities in 1918 is horrible. There is nothing left, and which of course sparks riots, strikes, walkouts from factories, and so on and so on, furthering the problems at the front and the issues they have in supplying their armies. But then you also have, of course, for Austria-Hungary, as you have in many other countries, but maybe especially for Austria-Hungary and the countries that fight on the Eastern Front, is that you have quite large zones of your country where the war is actually moving through at different times during the war. So Galicia is one of them where the whole thing changes hands a couple of times during the war, from after the Battle of Galicia, where the Austro-Hungarian armies withdraw to the Carpathian Mountains and the area comes under Russian control. They lose a lot of farmland. This is like the main farm area, and they lose a lot of that. It's damaged during the war. They don't recover it when they go back again and retake it later in 1915. All these things have an effect, and of course it also has an effect on the people who live in these areas, who live in what is like the hinterland behind the front, the zones behind the front. Also in Italy and stuff, the experience is of course much more violent than it is anywhere else. People there are subjected to really terrible atrocities. They're accused of spying for either side, whoever is there at the time, accuse them of being with the other people and helping them, and so on. So there are atrocities being perpetrated on the civilian population in these areas. When the food starts to go, when the economy crashes, when all these issues arise, you have much more steam going into this this idea of being independent, getting out of this empire. Yeah, the national tensions and the cry for independence, if you want, really grow as a result of the economy and the system, if you will, crashing. And then you also have a large movement of people, which will also have an effect. For example, in some of the big cities, you see a large influx of refugees from the east, a lot of Eastern Jewish people, and then that creates tensions between the people living there and these new people who come, and you already don't have the food for it, and you know, you have a growing anti-Semitism towards them. You have Italians coming, like Italians and Germans living in the border areas there, who flee the area, and they of course create tensions in some way here and there. So there are a lot of places where you have this rise of tensions between the groups because of the war. So for Austria-Hungary, the home front is not just one thing; it's a lot of different things, and really depending on where you are. But pretty miserable for most people. It's not like you have one group, even though that during the war, a lot of people in Austria have this idea that in Hungary they're just hoarding the food and they just have it all and they just don't want to share with us. But it's not always like that. There are some truths to it, that there is a reluctance to share what you have, but things in Hungary is also pretty miserable. You of course always have this when things are going well for Austria-Hungary and and the Central Powers. You have this idea that, oh, when we get Romania, we'll get a lot of food, and we'll get this peace with Russia, and we'll get a lot of food. You call it the bread peace, and there's this hope that every time, but it seems to always fail, that it isn't nearly as much as you want, or you don't have the people to cultivate the food, and you have a lot of just wagons of grain standing somewhere, and you can't really move them, and they just either rot or there isn't even enough to feed the occupation troops that you need to have in the area to make sure you get the food. There's a lot of this going on where you don't really get what you want, and which of course results in terrible conditions on the home front and the actual front line as well.
Yeah, I remember reading about when Germany and Austria-Hungary moved into Ukraine after the peace with Russia, and how they were, oh, we're going to get all this food that we can ship back to Germany, we can ship back to Austria, and then they could barely feed the soldiers that they sent there.
Yeah, I mean, goods. For example, Romania, it's all war is running through the country through most of most of the second half of 1916, war in Ukraine, the war is going back and forth. And during the first 3 years of the war, it's a constant movement of the war. And because of this movement of war, which is another thing that we talk about when we talk about, for example, the Eastern Front contra the Western Front, this much longer going war of movement, is that of course a lot of territory is being destroyed, a lot of cities are being destroyed, the farmers, the people who can do something about getting the food off the ground have all been scattered around. So there's a lot of issues there where you don't have what you expect, because you have this idea that this will just be great and in a minute we can just feed everybody, but then you start fighting, and there's infighting between Germany and Austria-Hungary as well. When they take, who gets it? Who's more important, Berlin or Vienna? Where should this load of trainload of grain go? It creates a lot of problems as well, and it never delivers what it promises.
Mm-hmm. And you know, all these problems on the home front, as you said, kind of exacerbated existing differences between various groups. And of course, after the war, the empire disintegrates into a number of smaller nations. But during the course of the war, those areas, you know, they were still loyal to Vienna, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, those men from those areas still fought well in the army pretty much until the end. You know, is that an accurate assessment?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of discussion. It's a relatively recent way to look at this issue, because for a long time after the war, a lot of the successor states started to write their history of the war, and it was much more focused on their, like, the Czechs were writing about the Czech history of the war and so on and so on. The Hungarians were writing about the Hungarian experience. And you got this very, some historians call it like a tribal history telling, where you tell it from only your own view. You don't really get the big story of the entire country. And with that, there comes this need to talk about your own soldiers as fighting their fight for their country. This is most pronounced in Czech post-war literature, because there is an independence movement during the war working for an independent Czech nation or Czechoslovak nation, depending on who you ask, but there's a need to sort of emphasize towards the allies during the war that, oh, we're forced to fight and we don't really want to be on their side. We're on your side. And to gain support for a nation, for an independent nation state, to the point where a lot of Czechs considered themselves after the war as being having been part, like having been on the side of the Entente of the Allies. And from there grows the idea of, okay, they were all just fighting badly and they saw the first chance to run to the enemy and surrender and so on. But it's not really what we see when you look at the cases that are there and the episodes that are portrayed. When you go down and actually look at what happened, it's more common that something else happened. So a unit that was completely demoralized and surrounded and had no other choice but surrender after the war is portrayed as, oh, they just threw away their weapons and ran to the Russians and jumped into their trenches and started firing at their own side and so on and so on. But yeah, what you see during the war is that pretty much all the different nationalities fight well. And you don't really see a mass desertion of any soldiers. You see local, of course, but even in the end, in 1918, in September, October, and stuff. When you look at like why I mean, and the Allies are doing this, you know, when they catch deserters that run to their side, they interview them, and some of the questions is, why did you desert? And the nationality thing doesn't really play a role at this point. It is, oh, we don't want to fight anymore. We don't want to die, or we don't have any food, which are all valid reasons for deserting. But you it is not really seen in this sense that it is a big issue in that way, and it is not something that affects the army's ability to fight, as it is often being portrayed, that it's just the army goes to the front and all the soldiers disappear and run away from their officers and they stand back and think, what happened? That is not an accurate depiction of what happens at all. It is very much this post-war historiography of the war and writing it in a very with a very specific aim and a very specific story to tell.
Yeah, and I guess at both like the official political level, there's probably a desire for that as they're working with other nations in the West, being like, hey, look at how, you know, we were fighting with you this whole time. And there's also probably from like an individual soldier perspective, you know, a Czech soldier, even if he'd served well in the Austro-Hungarian army, probably didn't necessarily want to trumpet that to everyone around him after Czechoslovakia was created. He, you know, probably works better for him if he talks about how much he was, you know, fighting for Czech freedom.
Exactly. And even more so for example, if you were an Italian soldier or a Romanian soldier or one of these other soldiers who basically ended up fighting against their motherland or fatherland in that way, fighting against them. But then you also have to recognize that there is also, during the war, a lot of focus on from the Austro-Hungarian side, from the mainly German and Hungarian, Africans are called mainly German, but Hungary as well. But this distrust of its own soldiers, which is not founded, but it, for example, throughout the war, there is a distrust of Czech soldiers. There is an idea that they are just waiting to run, which is also why this idea comes in the post-war, because it becomes a very easy scapegoat to say, oh, we just lost because the Czechs ran away. Oh, this operation failed because they were all Czechs, or they were not Germans, or they were not Hungarians, or whoever you are. These were Romanians, and we're fighting in Romania, so of course we lost this particular battle. And it can save the skin of a general sometimes to blame it. And they do all these they do a whole big study of the Czechs, for example, during the war, saying that many hundred pages on the loyalty of Czech troops and don't really come up with anything that there isn't this thing. But of course, in the post-war writings of the war, you have both the official history and the Germans saying that, oh, it was all the Czechs, and the Czechs are saying, yes, yes, that was us because we didn't want to fight you. And the truth or the reality is buried because both sides are interested in it being buried, which is an interesting mechanism in a way in the way the story is told, that that is only very recently that people have said, oh, let's look at these things and let's see, oh, this is not what happened. And sometimes where Czechs are fighting the Czech legions, which were made by recruiting Czech prisoners of war in Russia and Italy and other places as well. You have battles where Czechs fight Czechs, and it is hard to see a difference between the way a German regiment and a Czech regiment fought in those battles. But you have this distrust throughout the war, this distrust of your own soldiers and. During the war, there are a couple of regiments that are completely disbanded by the emperor for being not loyal. But two of them, the two that are both mainly Czech regiments. The most famous is the 28th Regiment, which is the one where you hear the story of them, you know, marching to the Russian side with the regimental band playing and the banners flying. It's not at all what happened. They are isolated and completely demoralized and are surrounded and forced to surrender. But the armies, they're struck from the army list of regiments and all that. But what you see is, for example, in that case, they disband the whole regiment. But because there's a battalion, like a replacement battalion on its way to Russia, of Czech soldiers to replenish this regiment, which is more or less annihilated in the Carpathians, they're diverted to the Italian front instead, and sent there where they perform extremely well because there's a different conditions there. Generally, most of the nations, because there is an idea, there is something about Slavs not being too fond of fighting Russians, but pretty much all of them are very keen on fighting the Italians, and they've performed very well on the Italian front to the point where the regiment is raised from this battalion again, like they're reinstated as a regiment because of how well they perform on the Italian front, and they're Czechs as well. So you can't see it like that. You can't say that one nationality fought worse than others, and especially when you go to the end of the war, where you can see who is leaving. Well, it's not always just the like some of the places where people fight the longest is very mixed. There's Czechs and Poles and a lot of different ones. Some of the majority of the units sent to the Western Front are Romanians. Fighting the French and the Americans, the majority of those regiments in those divisions that are sent there are from Transylvania, so they're sort of a mix of Romanians and Hungarians, but the majority of them are Romanians, and they perform very well there.
It's always interesting to hear kind of how, in the immediate post-war years, various groups and various nations sort of look back on their own participation. And that story seems particularly complicated, as you've kind of just described, for Austria-Hungary, due to all these other sort of factors that are involved that aren't really present in a lot of the other nations that were sort of fighting in the war.
Yeah, I mean, you do see it. I mean, there's this idea that Austria-Hungary is this very multinational state, but it is nothing compared to Russia. It is much more multinational, and many different types of religions and languages. And I mean, there's a lot of tensions between Finnish soldiers in the Russian army and Estonians and Latvians and Lithuanians and Polish regiments and Tatars, people of Muslim faith, and all these people recruited from different areas. There's a lot of tensions there as well. It's just not as well researched yet in Western and English literature. Let's say like that, because of course Estonia and Finland has their own historiography where this plays a big role, but it's not as well understood for in the English readership. Germany as well have a Frenchman from Alsace-Lorraine. They have Poles. They have Danes. So there are several multinational empires. The Ottoman Empire is, of course, another one where you have all different ones, where you have very big tensions, where you have Armenians in the army as well. Of course, creating some pronounced tensions between the different nationalities, but it becomes very much a part because the empire breaks up as much as it does. All these different nationalities have a lot to say about it afterwards, and it becomes very clear that is a multinational empire, that they're all, and it is a focus point of allied propaganda efforts and intelligence and so on to try to undermine this enemy by pushing these buttons and making it a fight about independence and about the dismemberment of the Habsburg Empire. So it does play a much bigger role in our understanding than maybe the others do. ¶¶